The headlines. Iran's top military commander says the U.S. and several Arab countries involved in the assassination of General Soleimani should be held accountable for the crime. The U.N. says civilian casualties in Afghanistan increased sharply after the start of the U.S. brokered peace talks last year. Also in the headlines, dozens of Boeing 777 planes are grounded worldwide following a Saturday incident involving a United Airlines flight in the U.S. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran says all those involved in the assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani must be held accountable. Chief of Staff of Iran's Armed Forces, Mohammad Baghari, said Soleimani's killing was an obvious crime and an act of state terrorism. He said that Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, Jordan, and Kuwait assisted the U.S. in its assassination of Soleimani. Baghari stressed that all those who helped Washington commit such crimes must be held accountable. He said that American planes targeted Soleimani's vehicle with armor-piercing weapons. General Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander were killed in a U.S. drone attack near Iraq's capital Baghdad in January of last year. Iran's foreign minister says regional countries are misguided if they believe that they can ever buy security from outside the region.
We invite all our neighbors to abandon their policy of buying security from outside and using proxies against Iran. We invite them to have interaction on regional security issues. Foreign interference has brought nothing for the region but insecurity. No one from outside this region will ever provide you with security. It is us who should provide our own security.
Mohammad Javad Zarif says Saudi Arabia and its allies have been spending billions of dollars on weapons sales and proxy wars against Iran. He said that has led West Asia to account for 25% of global weapon sales without boosting security there. The top Iranian diplomat said that the Saudis and others should learn a lesson from their past mistakes and help open up a new window to the region. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has slammed as arrogant the tone of the U.S. and the three European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei also denounced the West for failing to fulfill its commitments under the accord. In the meantime, Iran has announced the termination of its voluntary implementation of the additional protocol to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has slammed what he called the arrogant, high-handed, unjust, and erroneous rhetoric of the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal toward the Islamic Republic. Ayatollah Khamenei also denounced Britain, France, and Germany for failing to comply with their commitments under the nuclear agreement. The leader also lashed out at Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has repeatedly accused Iran of trying to acquire nuclear weapons. The leader added that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure and will not back down on its logical stance on its nuclear program. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei referred to a law passed by the Iranian parliament in late December that requires the government to take additional action to reduce commitments to the nuclear deal, which includes a decision to end the voluntary implementation of additional protocol. The leader said Iran will develop its nuclear capabilities in line with the needs of the country, and for this reason, Iran's enrichment purity level will not be limited to 20%. He said Tehran may increase the level to 60% if it deems necessary.
We should remember that the framework around this whole thing is that a number of nuclear powers are sitting telling what Iran should do, which is not a nuclear power, while other nuclear powers are not even discussed.
Following the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear agreement and its reimposition of sanctions in May 2018, Tehran exercised patience and remained fully committed to its obligations under the accord. However, a year later, Iran started to reduce its commitments in five gradual steps every 60 days, citing the failure of the European signatories to the JCPOA to uphold their end of the deal. In the meantime, Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, said on Monday that Tehran has terminated the voluntary implementation of additional protocol, which allowed snap inspections of Iranian nuclear sites. On Sunday, Iran and the UN nuclear watchdog reached an agreement for the continued inspection of Iranian nuclear sites for 3 months. Gharibabadi said Iran would record information at certain nuclear facilities without the supervision of the inspectors as per the new agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has recently expressed willingness to participate in an informal JCPOA meeting with Iran and other signatories. It has offered to hold talks with Iran over how to return to the deal. This is why Iranian officials have repeatedly and unequivocally rejected any preconditions or talks on the U.S. return to the deal, arguing that it was the U.S. that abandoned the accord and violated the U.N. Security Council 2231 that endorsed the multilateral agreement. Tehran says it will reverse its scalebacks to its commitments under the deal once all sanctions are lifted and all the signatories go back to full compliance.
Moving on, the U.N. says civilian casualties in Afghanistan escalated sharply after peace talks began last year. According to an annual report by the U.N. mission to Afghanistan, civilian casualties stood at more than 8,800 in 2020. That was 15% lower than the previous year. However, the report suggests a sharp uptick and historically high civilian casualties in the final 3 months of 2020. Casualties for the fourth quarter were up 45% compared with the same period in 2019. The Afghan government and Taliban militants began peace talks in September of last year. The talks were stalled for weeks and were just resumed on Monday. There's uncertainty over whether international forces will leave Afghanistan by May, as originally planned. Afghanistan has launched its coronavirus vaccination campaign aimed at inoculating hundreds of thousands. Doctors, security personnel, and journalists were among the first volunteers to receive shots. The Afghan President Ashraf Ghani says that 500,000 doses of the AstraZeneca COVID vaccine will be used in the first stage. The vaccines were donated by India earlier this month. Afghanistan has officially registered a total of 55,600 COVID infections, including over 2,400 deaths. The real numbers, however, are believed to be much higher, as limited testing has hampered efforts to track the virus. Amin Alami in Kabul says the presence of Taliban militants hampers efforts to deliver domestic and international aid to the Afghan people.
There is a very big problem on the way of not only the Afghan government and its health bodies, but also on the way of international health organizations, including WHO, because they say that most of the areas in Afghanistan, mainly in rural areas, are under the control of Taliban militants. Despite the Taliban confirmed that we will welcome medics to our territory, and we will also help them to implement their programs across our region. But this is not clear. Will the Taliban be honest regarding to this promise or not? The Afghan government, the people of Afghanistan, and even international bodies are calling on the Taliban militant group to not target medics.
Dozens of Boeing 777 planes have been grounded worldwide following a Saturday incident involving a United Airlines flight in the U.S. The flight out of Denver quickly returned to the airport after part of the engine caught fire and broke off. No one was injured, but aviation experts said the incident raised questions about the type of the engine and its maintenance. Boeing says nearly 130 aircraft with the same engine have now been grounded in several countries. The Denver incident is seen as a setback for the U.S. plane manufacturer. That's because Boeing has just recently resumed deliveries of another model, namely 737 MAX. The aircraft was grounded across the world last year following two fatal crashes. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. The European Union has imposed new sanctions against Venezuela over the country's December legislative elections. The new sanctions target 19 Venezuelan officials, lawmakers, and members of security forces. The EU accuses the sanctioned individuals of undermining the opposition's electoral rights, violating human rights, and restricting fundamental freedoms. Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza has criticized the EU, saying that the sanctions are based on false arguments about honorable citizens. He said the sanctions indicate that the EU is frustrated at its failure to change the government in Venezuela. The West claims that December's legislative election was rigged in favor of the party of President Nicolas Maduro, an allegation that Caracas rejects as baseless. Isaac Piggio is a political commentator who joins us from London. We also have Alfred Desayas, who is a former UN Special Rapporteur who joins us from Geneva. Welcome. Isaac Biggio, first over to you. Why is the EU so harsh when it comes to Venezuela? In this case, in point, sanctioning, 19 Venezuelan officials?
Well, the problem is that if you are a government that criticizes the United States, you are going to be sanctioned. Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela, Iran. And the European Union, for example, they didn't sanction Juan Guaido. He organized a referendum on the very same time as the Venezuelan official elections. People can vote 3, 4, 5 times. The results have not been clear. It was a completely fraudulent election, but they are still dealing with Guaido. Nobody sanctioned Colombia, that have 73 people killed in massacres, and it is only in the first 45 years of this year that Colombia is also trying to overthrow the Ecuadorian elections, that they sent a group of mercenaries to Venezuela to try to kill the president. No, the European Union is not sanctioning the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, despite that they bombed Yemen and destroyed Yemen. They intervened in Syria, in Libya. They created Al-Qaeda. So the sanctions are only to governments that are critical to the United States. Furthermore, in the European Union, there is one government, the Croatian government, that ethnically cleans the Serbian Republic of Krajina, but they are part of the European Union. Only if you are critical of the United States, you are going to be sanctioned.
Okay, so Alfred Dazayas, do you share the same views, and are we looking... why are we looking at a situation where you have the opposition leader, self-proclaimed president, Juan Guaido, who is waning in any type of popularity that he may have had, but it seems like he still has support coming from the U.S. and perhaps the EU?
Well, as you know, I'm not a politician. I'm a professor of international law, and that what really concerns me is not the hypocrisy of the European Union. You expect politicians to be hypocritical. What concerns me is that the European Union has a frontal attack on fundamental principles of international law, principles that are enshrined in the United Nations Charter, in General Assembly Resolutions 2131, 2625, 3314, in the Vienna Declaration on Program of Action, in the Millennium Declaration, etc. Principles like sovereignty, principles like sovereign equality of states, principles like the prohibition of intervention or interference in the internal affairs of states. That's all in the UN Charter. What's happening here is that the European Union is acting politically, and it is following a playbook that has failed every time. Result is that the European Union, that used to be a beacon of democracy and a beacon of human rights and respect for the rule of law, it's actually undermining all of that. Result, they have lost their credibility. They have lost the kind of respect that the world used to have for them. And not only in the third world, in the Human Rights Council. The council just started yesterday, Monday, and there's been very hard criticism against the United States and against the positions taken by the European Union, which are essentially anti-democratic. They are essentially anti-human rights. Now, take the disputed or so-called controversial elections in December, the parliamentary elections. The Consejo de Expertos Electorales de Latinoamérica, that is the oldest election monitoring organization that in Latin America that routinely observes the elections in all countries in Latin America, they were there, of course, for the elections on the 6th of December, and they ratified the elections as being legal, legitimate, and not rigged. Many opposition leaders participated in the elections, and they garnered about 20% of the votes. Now, the big parties, like the parties of Leopoldo López and Juan Guaidó, etc., they were invited to participate. Now, they boycotted the elections. Now, you cannot have it both ways. You cannot say, I will boycott the elections, and then when you don't get elected, you say, well, the elections were rigged. No, it's your own fault. There's a principle of international law called ex injuria, non oritur jus. And that means that you are stopped from making that kind of argument when you yourself have caused the problem. They were all invited to participate. They had the same access as all other citizens to vote. No one was blocked, and there was no violence whatever, because I had spoken with members of the Consejo de Expertos Electorales de Latinoamérica, the monitors. And there were, by the way, there are about 150 more veedores, what they call veedores, those are also international observers. But of course, no observers from the OSCE, because they don't want to legitimize it. So there, you have here a situation that is so, shall we say, mutually contradictory, the positions of the European state, but they do the same with regard to Russia. Now, the European Union has just imposed sanctions on Russia with regard to the Navalny case. But Russia is not a member of the European Union. Why don't they impose sanctions on Spain, that has 12 Catalan ministers and parliamentarians jailed only because they wanted to have a self-determination referendum? By the way, 12 Catalans who only advocated peaceful means, who did not engage in any kind of violence, they were punished for disobedience. Now, imagine what it would be if the European Union were to impose sanctions for, shall we say, the gross violations of human rights committed in the United Kingdom against Julian Assange. I mean, Julian Assange is being subjected to torture, to psychological torture. The human rights rapporteur, Niels Meltzer, the rapporteur on torture, has very strongly condemned the situation in the United Kingdom, the breakdown of the rule of law in the United Kingdom, the influence of the executive exercises on the judiciary, etc. The European Union doesn't speak. But it goes ahead and condemns Russia because of Navalny, condemns Venezuela because of elections that, as far as I could see, were entirely legitimate. Everybody was invited to participate.
Thank you very much for that. Alfred de Zayas, former UN Special Rapporteur. Thank you. Isaac Biggio, political commentator. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the sermons and letters and sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we have reached this section where we are discussing about the qualities of the pious people based on the sermon number 184. We reached the discussion of gluttony, where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains that one of those qualities of a person who is pious is that he avoids being gluttonous. Rather, his eating is controlled and is less. When he says mazuran akluhu, a pious person is such that his intake of food is less and controlled. And of course, we discussed about the physical effects of eating less. There are wonderful effects of eating less physically from the narrations. Of course, scientifically, you can all research in Google and you'll get a large amount of material regarding the scientific research on eating less and also its impact on old age. But I thought that we can have a discussion of the riwayat that are there, the narrations that are there regarding eating less. Inshallah, alhamdulillah, in the previous sessions we completed that. Now we want to discuss about the spiritual effect of taking care of food intake. So if you look at the narrations that we have, there are wonderful narrations that are there, you know, in this regard. First, I would like to draw attention to the issue of gluttony itself. Like, gluttony itself has got some very bad spiritual effects, and if we avoid that, then we can avoid those spiritual effects.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, one of those spiritual effects of gluttony is that from a narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, reportedly he says, there is nothing that gives that leads to greater loss in the heart of a believer than eating too much, because eating too much leads to two things. One, the heart becomes hard. And two, the desires increase, the sexual desires in a person increase. These are very important things that the Imam is mentioning. One of the things that we need to be really careful about is the hardness of the heart, because the heart is the center of all spiritual feelings. And if a person really wants to come closer to his Lord and feel the love of God in his heart, right? and feel kindness and goodness towards other human beings, then a person needs a heart that is sensitive, that is light, that is delicate, right? Such a good, soft, delicate heart can only come when a person controls his food intake. One who just eats and eats is strengthening this material dimension so much and is giving so much value and making this material dimension so used to that it is like it gives the final say in many things, and the spiritual aspects of a human being are ignored at the end, as I mentioned. So this is one thing that we need to really take into consideration. Another thing is the increase of desires. Of course, the amount of energy that increases inside a human body as a result of eating too much. And also the very fact that you are making it used to. You're like a person who eats too much is like allowing the soul to get what it wants, the body to get what it wants all the time. It gets a bit hungry, you give it. It wants more food, tastier food, different types of food, you give it. Now, when a person continuously gives it what it wants, now this part becomes very strong. It's like, you know, an animal that comes to your doorstep and you keep on feeding it, you know, nice, juicy pieces of meat, right? This animal is going to get used to your house. It's going to be at your doorstep fully. And this is how the material dimension will be always at the doorstep of your soul, taking the energy from it.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, as we said, one of those effects is the fact that the sexual desires become stronger in a person who eats too much. And that is why for young people who haven't yet gotten the opportunity to get married, or even people who are married, right? Okay, who are far from their spouses, they need to also keep track of their desires. A person, even after marriage, even before marriage, even more, even after marriage, lesser, to keep track of these desires. And one of those ways to keep track of the desires is by controlling the food intake. And I give a guarantee to a person who faces this issue of a lot of desires to keep control of their food intake. Just a small thing like not eating too much. We have got in narrations that a person comes to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam and says that I have got a lot of desires. The Imam tells him to fast. Okay, but of course, if cannot fast, then we can control the amount of food we have. Eat before you feel full. You feel full, you know. Until you feel eat when you are hungry and stop eating at that time when you still are a little bit hungry. Teach your soul to be under the power of the intellect. Teach it, train it like that. So actually it's a training session. And when you train the body to be under your control, to be under the control of the soul, this is how you strengthen. Keep the example of the animal that I mentioned nicely in your mind. The more you feed that animal, the more it will be at your doorstep. But if you control the amount of food you give it, it knows what time I need to get that food, how much I need to eat and how much not, when I have to come, when I don't have to come. But if you just are free with it, it's going to destroy your life system. So these examples are a way to give us some insight into trying to control our food intake and generally to keep the material dimension under control. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
والنور Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Embargo, directed by Jerry Rice. And joining me in the studio, we have Tim Robey, who is a film critic for the Daily Telegraph and who's also a regular guest on BBC Film 2017 and Radio 4's film programme. And beside him, we are also joined by Cuba expert Dr. Helen Yaffe, who is a lecturer at the University of Glasgow and has also written a book about Che Guevara's economic policies. Now, Embargo chronicles the story of the politics and collusion behind the Cuban embargo, its history, impact, and evolution, along with information from recently declassified documents and high-profile interviews. This film gives a unique perspective dating back before the 1959 Cuban Revolution that put Fidel Castro to power and led to the failed CIA-backed Bay of Pigs invasion and 1962's Cuban Missile Crisis. The film's compelling truths ultimately link the threads of an untold history and become the film's core message to end the embargo and looks to a future of rebuilding diplomatic and economic relations.
My father spent most of the 13 days in the White House, and he said that we had to be good soldiers and show up at school, that if there was a nuclear war, that none of us would want to be around afterwards.
Each small mistake could bring us to the confrontation. My father repeated, if we lose control, we will not be in charge.
Dad virtually told me nothing about Cuba. When Castro came in to overthrow Batista, my father must have been pretty thrilled, actually. You know, because you could remember Batista was not such a great guy.
We've been lied to since 1959 about Cuba, and we're still being lied to today. This unholy alliance between Nixon, the mafia, and the CIA still impacting us today.
At no time has the CIA engaged in any political activity that was not approved at the highest level.
We made it United States policy to assassinate Fidel Castro.
Wow, this is not what we bargained for. We just thought we were going to get rid of a corrupt government.
The president held out an olive leaf to Castro, and he said to him, the United States history in Cuba has been a history of atrocities, and we understand that we're going to have to pay for that in one way or another.
Now, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this is a film that takes a critical look at the U.S.'s trade ban on Cuba and the political turmoil between the two countries. And it also features lots of generous footage of archive footage and high-profile interviews with historical figures and celebrities alike. And Tim, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, the subject is fascinating and has been thorny and, you know, much contested for, 60 years now. My feeling is that the subject deserves a more incisive treatment than this film, and one which is more analytical and more focused in what it's trying to achieve. For me, it feels like a kind of fairly skimpy overview. It's like a kind of whistle-stop tour of Cuba's sort of greatest hits historically since the 50s, which sort of lets you sort of land on the big moments, but doesn't really explain them I mean, there are little nuggets of interest along the way, and some of the interviews do reveal things, but I felt that in general there was quite a lack of the kind of intelligence around the film.
It surely is a huge subject with lots of layers, and perhaps for audiences who are not familiar with this issue, it serves as a good introduction to the subject. Helen, if I could turn to you, as someone who spent many years in Cuba and studied Cuba, what was your take on this documentary?
I think precisely for the reasons that you're saying, it's a good, engaging documentary. It has that historical overview, which I guess that, you know, when you've studied Cuba, you know that history, you sort of take it for granted that others do. But it provides that. There's some great archival image. There's really good interviews. My only issue with it is that because it was called Embargo, I was hoping to see more focus on the embargo and, you know, the series of laws that were introduced at different points by different presidents in the United States and the impact that they've had on the Cuban people and on the rest of the world because of the extraterritorial nature of the embargo. But as a sort of general introduction, it didn't offer anything particularly new or novel, but it was, you know, some nice material and a good reminder of, you know, that relationship between the United States and Cuba. I do think that there were areas where more analysis would have been useful. Why was the United States so hostile against the Cuban Revolution? What was it that they were doing that was so unacceptable to the US power structure? So more on...
That's precisely the questions, actually, I'd like to ask you a bit later on.
The major premise of the American blockade of Cuba is to starve the Cuban people into submission or rebellion. It is a violation of all moral and legal standards to use the starvation of people as a foreign policy tool.
Well, the embargo was originally intended to wreak havoc in Cuba and create instability. There's no two ways around that. In 1965, Johnson then added food, for now part of the official embargo, and then medicine was also added as well.
I would say to all my fellow Americans, let us continue.
If a financial transaction takes place with American dollars abroad and an American bank is involved, that transaction is illegal. If a ship docks in Cuba to let off supplies that have been purchased legally by Cuba, that ship may not then proceed to an American port. It is a blockade that is unilateral only because no one else in the world wants to join the United States in this insane policy, but it is so extraterritorial in nature that it involves other countries whether they like it or not.
Tim, the documentary argues that the embargo failed both the U.S. and Cuba. What were the reasons laid out in the film for this?
Well, it's a little vague. This section of the film is the bit that deals with the embargo probably most fully. I wanted it to be fleshed out a lot more. It dates back to a whole history of kind of government antipathy between Fidel Castro and a succession of American presidents, and we see them sort of ticked off one by one, if you like. And the relationship just deteriorates. I mean, it's pretty bad with Kennedy, and it just gets worse and worse. By George W. Bush, it's really shocking. I really thought that the film could have focused on that entirely, and that would have been a very valid approach. Instead, we get a lot of other bits and bobs of kind of other sort of facets of Cuban kind of politics and history. Anyone who hasn't visited Cuba might struggle to kind of get the hang of the politics there and to get the hang of what a complicated country it is and the complicated relationship between the people of Cuba and Castro in his day, and also between Cuban Americans and Castro, who had quite a hostile relationship to him. The film does bring all of that up, and I was, you know, in some ways grateful to be reminded of some of those things. So yeah, it was interesting to delve back into all of this subject. I've been to Cuba myself, and it reminded me of a lot that I learned when I was there.
A good point that you raise, actually. There is a lot of propaganda against Cuba, so this film perhaps serves as a good counter-narrative to that propaganda.
It does up for a point. I sort of felt that sometimes it was being a bit sketchy about the specifics. I think there's some statistic that among imported goods into Cuba, still quite a lot comes from the USA, something between 6 or 7%, something like that. And you would think from this film that it was an absolute 0% blockade. So that kind of detail gets a little bit elided, I think, in the narrative.
And Helen, if I could turn to you now to shed more light on the embargo itself. Mm. It seems like from the documentary that the US was the only country in the world that had a problem with Cuba. And why were the reasons for this, and were they justified?
So after the revolution, it wasn't declared as socialist straight away. There was a period where there was tit-for-tat retaliations between the United States government and the Cuban government. So the process of nationalizations didn't take place until almost 2 years after the triumph of the revolution. And at the point where the Cuban government started to nationalize, they offered the foreign companies compensation based on the value that they had claimed their businesses were for tax purposes. And Canadian companies, French companies, they took the compensation. So that settled the claim. But in the United States, the Eisenhower government had told US companies not to accept compensation. Why? Because they were already planning the Bay of Pigs invasion, which obviously is inconceivable to them that it wouldn't work and they wouldn't be able to throw out the nascent revolutionary government. So that was, you know, the opportunity they were to resolve those issues. And subsequently, the US blockade or embargo, depending on who's speaking, has been, you know, it's the pretext has been it's a punishment for these nationalizations, but the reality has been it's always been at the center of a larger program which is trying to achieve regime change in Cuba.
And Tim, how damaging was the embargo? The film touches on this quite a bit. To Cuban society and what effect did it have as laid out in the documentary?
Well, yeah, it creates a kind of big divide in Cuba. I don't feel the doc really does enough of that, actually. And there are a lot of comparisons, interesting comparisons that could be made between kind of the American the welfare state and the Cuban welfare state, for instance, which the film just doesn't bother with. There are pros and cons of Cuban culture and life that I feel are left out. But I think perhaps what it would have been much better as is a much more focused one on just the embargo.
And Helen, the embargo itself, instead of Cuba falling down to it, actually, were they able to survive and not only that, thrive?
They were able to survive, and you know, let's be clear, in the initial period, that was thanks to the help from the Soviet Union. As you said, I focused my work on Che Guevara's economics, and you know, he had a dream. He was in charge of industrialization, of taking the most advanced technology in the world and implementing that in Cuba, but of course that was cut off, because immediately the US government was contacting the Prime Minister of Britain and saying, you cannot sell equipment or transport, you know, or anything to Cuba. So they had a very extensive trade. By the time that the Soviet bloc collapsed, 85% of Cuba's trade took place with that part of the world. And so, you know, in a sense, that trade had protected Cuba from the US blockade, from the impact of the embargo, because it didn't affect that trade. It could still carry out. The Soviet Union, Eastern Germany and so on weren't going to pay any attention. But the double whammy of the blockade was felt then in the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet bloc. And that's when Cuba entered something called a special period in time of peace. And that was my first experience of living in Cuba was in the 1990s. And, you know, it was extraordinarily hard. Even if you had dollars, you know, there was the pharmacies were empty, you know, food shops were empty, equipment just lay abandoned because they couldn't get the spare parts.
So the embargo was affecting the lives of everyday Cubans.
We made it, United States policy, to assassinate Fidel Castro. This was our policy, to bring down the Cuban government.
By the summer of 1959, the CIA is working with some mobsters to try and kill Fidel Castro. Nixon just ordered the CIA to ratchet up their plots with the mafia. Pretty audacious plan. It's now been very well documented, but only in the last 2 or 3 years when the National Archives found some files that really helped them lay some of this stuff out for the first time.
Dr. Castro, an American magazine published a story this week which says that Dr. Castro really hates America.
When am I going to hate to the people of the United States? I don't hate anybody.
Someone who's not familiar with the subject, some of these revelations in the documentary might seem like a bombshell, really. And you would think some of these things were conspiracy theories, these plots to take down Castro. Tim, were you surprised by this and by some of the findings and evidence of the documentary?
I wasn't really surprised because I've seen some of the films about Castro, for instance, and Oliver Stone made a film about him, and I've read books on the subject. This film does come down rightly very hard on the CIA and kind of presents it as sort of a banker-funded mafia with its own interests in the stock market at heart. And you see that the kind of successive attempts of the CIA to kind of unsettle the Castro regime and unseat him, and it goes as far as assassination attempts. But again, I would love to have seen much more specific evidence of that. You could really go into the details on that and kind of deal with it. We get a little bit of documentation, but really not very much. I feel as though it's the makings of a really compelling kind of conspiracy-themed doc on that subject, which is very different from the doc about the embargo that we're sometimes getting as well. So they kind of sit side by side a little bit uneasily. I did find that section of the film kind of picked up the pace a little bit. I'll give it that.
It was incredibly exciting and fascinating, actually, this part of the documentary. And Helen, if I could turn to you, just going back about the assassination attempts on Castro. I mean, according to another documentary, 638 Ways
which
to
I was
Kill
gonna mention,
Castro,
yeah.
Fabian Escalante claims that there have been over 600 times attempts on Castro's life over a span of 40 years.
Yeah.
Why were there so many attempts, and then why did they fail?
I think two things are important. One is that the US government has never understood what a revolution means, in the sense that they have such a sort of personalized politics. They felt like taking out Fidel would destroy what was a mass movement, a revolution. And secondly, because of what he represented, and that's another element I think is missing, you know, the fact that Cuba was able to implement free universal healthcare, education, access to culture and so on. And what does that say in exposing the US model, where they say, you know, you have to pay for healthcare, and if you don't, you're left to die in the street. So, you know, really the biggest threat that Cuba presented was not the Soviet missiles that were there in 1962, but the biggest threat was the sort of threat of an alternative form of development. And that's what, you know, the US was so afraid of contaminating the rest of Latin America.
And Tim, if I could turn to you, would you have any thoughts to add to what Helen just said apart involving with the film?
On the subject of this spreading to Latin America, domino theory stuff, I guess, that's an interesting one as well. And yeah, the degree to which Cuba could be a kind of like a ringleader in that sense. There are films about that as well, and there are films about the Cuban Missile Crisis specifically.
Yeah.
There's 13 days, as mentioned, the 13 days in which it
happened. Perhaps what's unique about this documentary, then, as by first-time filmmaker Jerry Rice, is that she was so taken by this subject, and she involves herself in the journey. So from the perspective of sort of a layman's point of view, this takes you on that journey also.
It does. She starts off as quite a presence in the film, and you kind of get the sense of her kind of journeying there and this conversation that she had with Castro on a bus. And then she sort of drops out of it, and it sort of tries to become a bit more of an overview, and she kind of comes back in a little bit at the end. But I don't want to be overly negative, because there are things of value here, but I feel as though the film is indecisive about whether it's a personal treatise on Cuba and on the embargo, or if it's more of a kind of impersonal overview of the subject. I think it never quite makes its mind up, and you can kind of sense the vagueness in it, because sometimes the film will transition from one subject area into another, a little bit of music thrown in just to kind of help us over the bumps. I felt as though there needed to be much more of a sense of structure. Perhaps she started the film too early and hasn't got enough material from the last couple of years. There have been a lot of changes, as we'll talk about. And perhaps what it's missing is that most recent stuff that would really have helped kind of build the argument a bit more forcefully.
I
think even in terms of the embargo, I mean, you know, people are talking about it in the past tense, especially since Obama announced rapprochement with Cuba.
President Trump will treat the Castro regime as a malevolent dictatorship that it is. Thank you, President Trump. You have not betrayed us. You kept your promise! I am so thrilled to be back here with all of my friends in Little Havana.
And you mark my words. And you mark my words. Whether it's in 6 months or 6 years, Cuba will be free.
We just didn't fight hard enough. Now, those days are over. Now, we hold the cards. We now hold the cards. We will enforce the ban on tourism. We will enforce the embargo.
And Helen, as I noticed that you're shaking your head at Marco Rubio, why was that?
Marco Rubio has some leverage over Trump, and he seems to be playing the tune that Trump is dancing to at present. It's worth pointing, as a businessman, Trump sent his representatives to talk to the Cuban government about business opportunities in 1998, when it still was illegal before rapprochement, and also in the early 2000s. So Trump, with his businessman hat on, had, you know, said, I have no problem with lifting the embargo. And in fact, he said that at the beginning of his electoral campaign. But obviously, when he became a serious candidate, he had to do the done thing and go to Miami and win the support of the Rubios and the other Cuban-American politicians. And he obviously, you know, made deals with them.
Of course, Florida was a turning point in the election for Trump winning. Tim, if I could turn to you, how was Trump portrayed in this documentary, and is he shown as responsible for reigniting the hostility between the US and Cuba?
He is shown as doing that in that clip, which is pretty much the last 2 minutes of the film. That is it, what we've just seen. That's the only time we see Trump. What strikes me about that clip is that it's cut like a trailer. It was incredibly fast, and the footage was just flowing in. The music's really hammering this out. You could watch a 90-minute film just on that. And instead, we end with this kind of rapid-fire trailer montage of the harm that Trump has done. It really is all too hasty, I think. I wanted commentary on that. I wanted people talking about that. I wanted analysis of that. Instead, we just see his speech. We see it happening. And then we kind of go home and hope that things change.
But there's only so much time, I suppose, you can cram into a documentary.
Of course, yeah. But I just feel as though it's biting off more than it can chew fundamentally. And I think if it had just focused a bit more, I think we would have a more valuable film.
I mean, you know, like under the Obama administration, there were more fines against third countries and companies in third countries.
But of course, wasn't Obama trying to ease relations with Havana?
He did too little too late. The U.S. embargo or blockade is codified in U.S. law. It can only be lifted by a vote in Congress. But as the president, he could issue executive decrees. And those he did issue on very limited basis to allow, you know, 6 airlines to fly from the United States to Cuba and a couple of hotels. But he could have gone far further, and he didn't. And in fact, you know, under Obama, some of the fines were astonishingly high. So the French Bank Paribas was fined nearly $9 billion for, interactions with financial interactions, not just with Cuba, also with Sudan and Iran. And then, you know, the fines are just endless. If you read the Cuban motion to the United Nations General Assembly when they have the annual vote, it will list some of the fines, and they go up right to the end of the Obama administration. So it was a very sort of two-sided coin.
Relations.
Exactly.
I'm afraid I'd love to talk more on this topic, but we've run out of time on the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.